You are now listening to the Autoimmune Doc Podcast with Dr. Taylor Crick. Dr. Taylor is an expert in helping those suffering with autoimmune disease, and he himself has autoimmune disease. Autoimmunity is rampant today. The purpose of this podcast is to educate about the underlying causes and natural solutions to halt autoimmune disease progression. This podcast is for educational purposes only and is not intended as medical advice. For more information from Dr. Taylor, visit www.autoimmuneeducationacademy.com. Without further ado, here's your host, Dr. Taylor Crick.
Welcome to the Autoimmune Doc Podcast. This is your host, Dr. Taylor Crick. I love teaching people the underlying mechanisms behind autoimmunity and chronic disease. I feel like when you understand the mechanisms, everything starts to make sense and your solutions then become obvious. And today's episode is you know, a popular one with mechanisms, but it's food sensitivities. Food sensitivities and autoimmunity. For more information, just in general, for food sensitivity tests, for other things, visit our website at www.autoimmuneeducationacademy.com. We're going to be getting some other things up there too, like schedule a free 15-minute phone consult with me, some things that we offer through my clinic. I do that already, but some of you have found me through my clinic's website and scheduled those. But we're going to get those on Autoimmune Education Academy. That site continues to be built out. So make sure that you go there, you subscribe to the podcast so that you know when podcast episodes come out. But also at the website, you can subscribe to our email list. There's articles and yeah, et cetera. The lab testing too that we're going to talk about today. But food sensitivities, that's today's episode, episode number 10. And let's just jump right into it. Food sensitivities are a known trigger and cause of autoimmune disease. And I think that if you've made it this far in the podcast, or if you're somebody who's exploring the world of autoimmunity, you probably know that. So this is something that's, you know, it's honestly a little controversial in the literature and with labs and things like that, but it's well accepted by autoimmune patients. Even when your food sensitivity testing might be less than remarkable, people notice triggers when they eat certain foods. So let's talk about it. So obviously, celiac disease and the gluten association with that is a known trigger. So food sensitivities are for sure a known trigger. But there's also non-celiac gluten sensitivity and many other sensitivities. Next podcast episode, I'm going to focus on gluten specifically and just talk about why is gluten so bad. And talk about some of the most common like false negatives with gluten lab testing that I see all the time. But we're going to go into gluten. But gluten is the worst, but it's something that patients, you know, definitely correlate with their symptoms and with their flares or their remission or the management of their autoimmune reactivity. And hence, you know, even the popularity in our world of things like elimination diets and food sensitivity testing. You know, right now, Everly Well is just really, really good at marketing, which I'll say at the beginning, I think their tests from what I've seen are crap, but they're really, really, really good at marketing. So they're very popular. Elimination diets, you know, Whole30, you know, I don't know, a few years ago, I would have said it was the most popular diet in America. There's always kind of a diet of the year, but Whole30, autoimmune, paleo, obviously in our space, very, very popular. And there are many people that just right at the beginning that I want to give a shout out to and give credit to. But some of our researchers, like Dr. Fasano, big researcher in the gluten space, Dr. Vajadani, obviously one of my mentors, and just a big researcher in food immune reactivities in general. We're going to talk about him a lot today. Dr. Karazian, obviously a mentor of mine, and you know, one of the first people on the scene to talk about how your food immune reactivities were triggering your autoimmune reactivity. Sarah Ballantyne is another one, just commonly thought of as the founder or the popularizer, is that a word? Of the autoimmune paleo protocol. So yeah, a lot of people out there that have you know, talked about this in the past. And again, the next episode is going to be on why is gluten so bad. And then the episode after that, number 12, is going to be on eating for autoimmunity. So these elimination diets, autoimmune paleo, something that we have called the 10 steps of autoimmune eating. But yeah, these are wildly popular and it's been around a while. So let's go through the details, you know, just really quickly of how this happens, because it's kind of hard to say verbally without drawing it. You know, I'm a visual person. But again, I think that a lot of us have seen the drawing of the cartoon like gut lining, and that's what happens. So undigested food proteins or partially digested food proteins, meaning these proteins haven't been broken down completely into amino acids. So they're protein structures. Now, the metaphor for this really quickly that I use a lot is that, you know, let's say you're eating a burger. That burger's like a burger statue maybe that's made out of Legos. Well, your digestive system has to go in and break down all those Legos into their individual pieces so that those Legos can be used to rebuild brain cells, hair, skin, nails, heart, eyes, liver, you know, whatever. So it's these and when your food is partially broken down, it's like, let's say you have three Legos stuck together, like a red, white, and blue. Well, those aren't fully broken down so that you can rebuild hair, skin, nails, things like that. So those foods are partially broken down. So you have undigested food proteins, partially digested food proteins that get through a leaky gut, okay? And there are other things that happen. There are some other nuances to this that were, you know, a lectin pathway or dendritic cells can sample food proteins in the lumen in the absence of a leaky gut, but that's the general concept and it's true. And this is widely regarded as a root cause of all autoimmunity. I would say though that a lot of autoimmunity, you know, foods might be a root cause, but they're not necessarily the solution every time. They're an important part of it. But a lot of people that I see have done AIP for a year or multiple years, have done food sensitivity tests, have done leaky gut protocols, and it just hasn't gotten it hasn't gotten in their solution. But so these undigested food particles enter in through a leaky gut, which is basically like a fence in your garden that has holes in it. So rabbits are getting in. So these undigested food proteins are getting in there. And then your immune system is recognizing those. So those foods are triggering inflammation. They're triggering, and this is typically measured as an IgG antibody, which is more of a delayed immune response. But they're triggering this inflammation and raising this just generalized kind of T cell response with the IgG antibodies. Then the other thing that doesn't get talked about as much, you know, we hear about like, oh, your immune system attacks the food. But what happens a lot of times is something called molecular mimicry. And what that means is, again, that like, what if your gluten, or let's say your piece of bread that you ate had three Legos again, and it was red, white, and blue Legos. Well, what if your thyroid also has red, white, and blue Legos in order like that? Your immune system could see that and think, oh, I know what that is. That's my enemy, gluten, when it's really the thyroid. And so that's a process called molecular mimicry, where the body can develop a response to a certain food like gluten or dairy or corn or soy, and then it can in turn turn and attack certain tissues. So that's something that too, that as we're going through autoimmunity, if you've got rheumatoid arthritis, it's important to know what your food cross reactors are. If you have cerebellar autoimmunity, it can be important to know what your food cross reactors are. I have a video out there that's like the food cross reactions with Epstein-Barr and Lyme antibodies, because Lyme and Epstein-Barr antibodies can bind to certain foods and think that they're Lyme or Epstein-Barr and trigger this immune response. So your body's kind of always trying to fight these things, and it can lead to tissue damage if it's binding joint tissue, if it's binding brain tissue, if it's binding thyroid tissue, and then triggering an immune response towards those things. It can eventually lead to tissue damage, which is autoimmunity, right? So again, foods as a trigger for autoimmunity. And there are many really, really good graphics. Like, I have several great graphics, even on my Instagram, if you scroll down and past graphics, from the literature, some of them from Dr. Vijayadani, some from others, but about how this happens is you get a breakdown in the barriers, food proteins enter, you lose what's called immune tolerance, so your immune system begins to mark something as an enemy, and step by step, it leads to autoimmunity. So that's why food sensitivities, you know, are bad. So again, what are the most common foods? So the most common ones I mentioned are gluten. But gluten, you know, again, we're going to talk about it next episode, but I would say grains. When we talk about gluten, we're talking about grains also. Many grains like rice and corn, for example, will cross-react with gluten antibodies. So that's why even with many elimination diets, they're not just gluten-free, they're grain-free. Rice, quinoa, corn, any wheat, even gluten-free wheat, cutting those out because there's a lot of cross-reactivity. Gluten is number one. Dairy is number two, a close number two. Then eggs, I would say. And again, I'm saying off the top of my head of what I see clinically. Soy. Gluten, dairy, eggs, soy. You know, corn's another one. You know, sometimes people, nuts, et cetera. But those are the big ones. And let's just stick with that. So those are the big ones. Gluten, dairy, eggs, soy. So the gold standard from the scientific community is still an elimination diet. So the gold standard is eliminating these foods for a period of time and then reintroducing those. It's called an elimination and provocation diet. You eliminate it for a while, then you provoke the immune system by trying to eat those foods again. So let's say it's dairy, and you cut that out for 30 days or so, and then you add it back in, and you look to see what you feel. I have people, you know, I've got a zillion stories. I had somebody recently that said, I know I can't do milkshakes, I poop my pants. And I kind of laughed, and she said, no, I'm serious. I said, okay, I believe you. I had another gentleman recently, and he said, boy, now when I eat gluten, I can feel it in my hands. And a lot of times you feel it in certain areas. Now, gluten, two-thirds of gluten sensitivities are felt neurologically. So it's not like you get GI or you get cramping or you get bloating or you poop your pants. A lot of them are felt in the joints or are felt in the brain or with brain fog. A lot of egg sensitivities will be felt in the joints. So a lot of times it's just puffiness or pain. But that is still the gold standard. Now, that's really tough, though, because a lot of times these sensitivities are delayed. So you want to add the foods back in on a rotational scale. You want to wait a couple days before you add in another food. And it's really hard. It's really hard that, like, it's just even a hard concept to think of that the pizza and ice cream and beer that you drink on Friday night could cause your headache or your anxiety or your shoulder pain on Monday morning, and you're never connecting those dots of thinking that one caused the other. But that is the gold standard. And again, when people just stop doing those foods, that's the important part, then they're able to notice it. One of the metaphors that I use is like if somebody's a cigarette smoker, you give them a cigarette, they don't even notice it, right? But if you give somebody who's a non-smoker a cigarette, they're going to be hacking up a lung because their body's not used to it. And it's the same thing after you cut something out, after you cut gluten out, then you reintroduce it. It's like, whoa, I can really feel that. Or you cut eggs out, or you cut, you know, whatever it is out. And then when you eat it, you can really feel that. So a couple examples of just elimination diets that I use, you know, all the time, these three. The Institute for Functional Medicine has one. It's gluten-free. It's not grain-free. It's kind of an easy one, really. And it's the foods are weirder, so I don't use it nearly as often as AIP or even Whole30. But it cuts out red meat, not all meats, but just red meat. It cuts out gluten, dairy, eggs, corn, soy, alcohol, coffee. Those are all pretty typical. A Whole30, which again is just wildly popular. Yeah, something that people just have great success with. And I think that the best thing about Whole30 is not that it's some miraculous food plan. It's similar to many others. But boy, when people do Whole30, it changes their relationship with food. It changes their mindset more than any of these others. It's going to be all grains. It's very paleo-based. So it's all grains, dairy, alcohol, eggs, legumes, and anything processed. So that's an important part of a lot of these. Anything processed, sugar a lot of times is eliminated too. Whole30 coffee is encouraged, but on IFM, coffee is eliminated. So there's just different nuances to all these diets. And then AIP is the most intense. And again, two episodes from now is going to be an episode about that. I have a video about AIP, and we use it really often. I have people that have come in with a lot of experience with AIP from their research and stuff like that. But it's all grains, all dairy, eggs, soy, nightshades, which are like potatoes, cucumbers, things like that. Lectins, which are in legumes, which are also in nightshades, and gluten is a lectin, and other things with lectins. And again, anything processed. All of these are going to be anything processed, anything sugary, anything in a box or a can or anything like that. Try to cut that out. Because again, even with a lot of food sensitivities, sometimes they're not food protein. Sometimes they're food additives. And that's, another topic. But food additives are so common in processed foods, and they're major, major autoimmune triggers. So sometimes you might not be triggered by, whatever food, let's say broccoli. I don't know. That's a bad example. But the packaging that it comes in, or the additives that might be part of it, could cause you to be flaring from it. If you want to understand the science behind this better, send me a message or email me. But there is an amazing journal that I have the full text to, and it's an entire journal issue. I'm going to read through just the title of the articles right now. But again, it's by Dr. Vijayadani. Dr. Vijayadani publishes research with Dr. Karazian, and he is the medical director of Cyrex Labs and runs, and he really was the founder of IgG food sensitivity testing. And he talks about that a lot in this episode. I want to go through it quick. And again, I have another whole video reviewing this journal. But yeah, and it just talks about, let's see, first we have even from the editor, the editorial. And this is interesting. He says approximately 1 ton of food goes through our gut every year, including more than 220 pounds of protein, attesting to the fact of the effectiveness of the immune system in protecting us from adverse reactions. The disturbance of this homeostasis of the immune system by environmental factors can lead to food immune reactivities. And talks about how that can fuel autoimmunity. So in this entire journal, he sent out a request for people to submit papers that add labs, and nobody replied, but Dr. Vijayadani replied with, like, I think 7 different articles. So the entire issue is all articles by Dr. Vijayadani. This would be like if Sports Illustrated did an issue and every article in there was by the same sports writer. It's pretty unheard of. But so I'm going to just read the articles. The first one is The Evolution of Food Immune Reactivity Testing: Why IgG or IgA testing may not be reproducible from one lab to another. So that's something that's worth mentioning, that he has this whole article about, that many labs aren't reproducible. Quality absolutely matters. And I see a lot of food sensitivity tests that I just quite frankly don't trust. And often on the false negative side, somebody comes in and they're like, I know gluten is a problem, but I only got 1 star out of 3 stars or whatever their test has. But again, this talks about it, the reproducibility, the correlations. It's a long, I'm scrolling through it. Da, 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 da. I've got a bunch of stuff highlighted in it, but I was just showing the title. That's a really long one. It talks about just the science behind this testing and how important it is to have reproducible tests. You know, with Cyrex, that he is the director of, Cyrex is the only lab that uses raw and cooked food antigens. Most labs only use raw food antigens. So if they're testing red meat, they're testing raw red meat. If they're testing, egg white, I don't know about that. That one. But yeah, so most labs use just raw food antigens. The next article is oral tolerance and its relation to food immunoreactivities, which is probably the most important article, because understanding tolerance is, again, understanding why your immune system is reactive to one food and not to another. We want oral tolerance. He talks about in this article about how tolerance develops from birth onto life, and yeah, just goes into the science. And again, this is, it's deep science. That's why I'm not going into it too much. But he talks about all the things that play into tolerance, like your age and were you breastfed and what's your vitamin D level and your diet and your allergies and any drugs and your genes, and all the different factors that support tolerance. The next article is about molecular mimicry. So I already talked about that, but again, that's a really, really important one. It explains, the article is called Molecular Mimicry as a Mechanism for Food Immune Reactivities and Autoimmunity. And again, I mean, just really stinking good. Good pictures in here too. I'm scrolling through the whole journal. Lectins, agglutinins, and their roles in autoimmune reactivities. So again, lectins have been popularized by Dr. Stephen Gundry just in more recent years. But yeah, it's a really, really important thing is understanding these things. So again, if you want to know the science behind it, if you want to see a review of the literature, this is a great resource that I can send you. Then there's a couple more, immune reactivity to food colorings. So again, you know, I have three kids. That's important to me. Food colorings are associated with leaky gut, failure, interference with digestive enzymes, failure in oral tolerance, hyperactivity, hypersensitivity, asthma, sinus problems, things like that. And then immune reactivities against gums. That's the last one. So these gums that are additives, these gums that are packaging things that are used, I guess it's not the last one. Then there's another one. Immune reactivities to peanut proteins, agglutinins, which are lectin, and oleosins, which are in a lot of different oils. And again, I don't need to spend the whole time on this paper. I have a whole nother video going through the paper that you can watch, and I can send you the paper if you're curious, but really, 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 really comprehensive entire journal about foods and their correlation with autoimmune reactivities. So a couple of the things that I think are really important to know, sometimes people feel their food sensitivities, sometimes they don't. Sometimes they're neurological. Sometimes they're delayed. Sometimes they don't realize that the reason that they can't remember what they were doing 5 minutes ago might be from a food immune reactivity or might be from a million other things. So it's not always that easy. And sometimes people, again, they get a food sensitivity test. They cut out all their triggers. Sometimes it absolutely changes their life. Sometimes it absolutely does nothing. And so that's really, really tricky. And again, in the autoimmune management world, I see a lot of people kind of after they've taken these first steps, they've done food sensitivity tests, they're bringing me their labs, they've been gluten-free for a long time, but they're still having flares or they're still having symptoms. If it's on a test, it's still important to cut them out anyway. That's the last thing I want to talk about is the food sensitivity testing. And again, how it's not reliable for many labs, but what are some of the good options? And there are, and I want to just mention this, that there are some testing methods that sound really fancy. You know, if you are a lab, you know, if you listen to any labs, like their stuff is amazing. And if you listen to my last podcast, I even talked about that. Everybody's pitch is really, really great and like blah, blah, blah. So they're all like, my lab's better than yours because of this. My lab's better than yours because of this. But what's out there in the literature and what's out there in the data? And one thing that my mentor, Dr. Karazian, said at one point that stood out to me, he said, hey, listen, you guys, there might be practitioners out there getting good results with these labs. But if I developed a study and I took it to my review board at Harvard, they would laugh me out of the room because this testing method is not considered the most valid. So the most valid is ELISA, ELISA IgG for foods. Sometimes they test things like IgG4, sometimes they test things like IgE, but ELISA IgG. Cyrex is my recommended. Again, so they do a 180 foods panel. And then they also do a 90 foods version, which is like 90 of the most important ones. Then they also do other panels like the Array 3X, which is the gluten and gluten-associated things. We'll talk about that a lot next podcast episode. Array 4 is a lot of gluten cross reactors. But yeah, so that's my recommended lab. Now, I also do use Great Plains. And I've tried others. You know, I've tried some cheap ones of like, hey, if I can get this for $350, why don't I just get it for people for $200 or $150? They just kind of suck, really. And that's what I think, again, about Everlywell. There's, you know, there's an OBGYN in my town that runs a lot of food sensitivity tests that people bring to me. And I think they're kind of garbage. I just don't trust them. Just straight up. If what yours tells you helps you, I'm all for it. I don't think that there's false positives. I think there are false negatives. But I do use Great Plains because I feel like it's fairly sensitive and it's a finger prick. And it looks for, again, 180 or close to 200 foods. And it also looks for reactivity against Candida. And I think that both of those are available on the website. But a couple other things with this is, how long do you have to cut foods out? Well, who knows? You know, I have patients who are able to reintroduce foods and they're fine after a month. I have patients who have done AIP for a long time and they try to reintroduce eggs and they're like, oh, nope, can't do that. And then 2 months later, they try to reintroduce eggs and they're like, oh, nope, can't do that. And then 6 months later, it's like, oh, okay, I think that I can do eggs now. And there's a lot of nuances and mystery to this. But if we're eliminating other triggers from other areas and we're strengthening things on a barrier level and on a cellular level and we're detoxifying and all these things, I do believe that the body does heal. But it's normal to have some food sensitivity. So it's not a problem if you know you have some food sensitivities. Your body should develop IgG reactivity to things that it sees fairly often. The problem is when you have it in the context of a leaky gut or a leaky blood-brain barrier, and then you're just generating a lot of this inflammation, or you're getting the tissue cross-reactivity, and then now you have an autoimmune disease. Now your immune system recognizes something like your collagen or your tendons that never leave you, so it's always going to be mounting an attack against that. So that was a lot of info about foods. It wasn't a whole lot of direction, but again, some of the options are elimination diets, which again, we have resources for. I actually like Dr. Karazian's ebook for the AIP, and then I also use Mickey Trescott's books and Sarah Ballantyne's books. We have all those in our office and in our store. But for my patients, I'll share with them Dr. Karazian's. And you can get that on his website, too. I'm not trying to steal anything from him, but drknews.com, he's got a really, really good ebook explaining AIP. Whole 30, you can get the Whole 30 book. It starts with food. IFM one, that's something that we share with people. And yeah, again, hopefully that helps. I'm just trying to make sure that I recapped everything, but I think that I did. So give me a comment, please. Give me a review. Please share this with somebody. I didn't say it at the beginning. I actually kind of forgot. But share this with somebody. Somebody that's had foods testing. Somebody that knows they have a food sensitivity. Your crazy friend who always brings their own gluten-free stuff over to your house. Yeah, share this with somebody and hopefully it helps. Check out some of that other information on our website. And stay tuned for the next episode, which is going to be about gluten and why is gluten so bad. And then the following one after that, eating for autoimmunity and AIP and some of these elimination diets. So thanks. Talk to you guys next time.